ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Nightlife Science.
Associate Professor Charlie Lineweaver is with us again. Charlie, as you know, is an astrophysicist at the ANU's Research School of Astronomy and Astrophysics. And he joins us this evening. Charlie, good evening. Welcome back.
Good evening, fellow life form.
Yeah, well, I am sort of a life form, some of the time anyway, at least.
Now, all the time, Phil. All the time.
All the time. Hey, now, we are in some ways, you've suggested we're closing in on the origin of life, because there's been a suggestion, hasn't there, that life came from the stars via an asteroid maybe, or a comet that deposited these things on Earth. Sounds as though that might be right.
Well, you know, the origin of life is a gigantic mystery. And for those of us, we're scientists, we think we have to have a naturalistic explanation, not a supernatural one, but a natural one. And that involves trying to figure out how life could have gotten started.
Yeah.
Well, what's interesting is over the past, let's say, I don't know, maybe five decades, we've realized, even before 100 years maybe, we realized that the elements of life that you and I are made of, every school person should know this, everybody should know this, and that is for C, well, actually, I remember it with Hock and Piss. HOC, that's hydrogen, oxygen, carbon. N is nitrogen. And piss is phosphorus and sulfur. Those six elements are the building blocks of life. But notice those are elements, not molecules. And so in the environment, right now you're breathing oxygen, but you're not breathing oxygen. You're breathing O2, which is molecular oxygen. Mm. You're breathing nitrogen, but no, you're breathing N2, which is molecular nitrogen. So all the ingredients of life, they're not elements. You find elements on the surface of the sun. When you heat up these molecules, they dissociate and they turn into elements. But here we're surrounded by molecules. And the molecules are also made out of these elements, these six elements. But they're let me back up. You haven't studied biochemistry, have you?
No.
Okay. All right. So biochemistry is made out of really, really, really complicated proteins. You know, so many – the gigantic molecules of thousands of elements. So – but if you look at all life, you can say, what are the simplest molecules you can find in life? And they're still really complicated. Mm-hmm. So as scientists, the problem is, how do you get from these molecules that are common everywhere that we see we see them all over the place, to these biomolecules? And the more complicated the molecule we can find that are everywhere, the easier it is for us to go from step A, non-life, through molecular evolution to life. And so what this new evidence from Bennu, and I should have mentioned also from this comet, this third interstellar comet, Atlas. And so they've used a new instrument to look at it. It is now no longer behind the sun. And they were able to see lots of HCN. HCN is hydrogen cyanide, and lots of CO2. And they said, whoa, we're seeing so many of these. Why are we seeing so many of these volatiles? And the simple answer to that is that this thing has come from the outer parts of another solar system and traveled through interstellar space and has never in its entire life been close to a star. And all the comets that we see have been close to our sun, sometimes millions and millions of times, and that means they've been devolatilized. So that's one reason why this new comet is giving off these wonderful, very volatile molecules. But I guess the big result is from this Bennu analysis, and that is they found ribose. And ribose, as you know, you've heard of RNA, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So the R is for ribose. And you've heard of DNA, and interestingly, we haven't found deoxyribose.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a different type of sugar. And we have DNA in it, but we also have RNA. And by studying the history of life, we know that RNA preceded DNA. And so finding ribose kind of backs up the idea that ribose could have been produced first, turned into life, and then only later evolved into DNA. So this is a really big combination of molecules that are evolving, and we're finding more and more complicated ones and more of them.
So the idea is that an early comet, you know, back at the dawn of time, smashed into the Earth and deposited these things here.
Yes, yes. Hmm. Well, not only smashed into the Earth, the whole Earth is made out of these things, right?
Yeah.
So stuff from outer space is always falling into Earth. Matter of fact, the whole Earth is made of stuff that fell from outer space.
Hmm. Speaking of impacts, by the way, it seems more than one giant impact may have produced our moon. Now, the theory is that you know, a very large thing bashed into the Earth and broke off a whole lot of stuff, which solidified and became the moon.
Yeah, that's the conventional theory. That has been the conventional theory for about 40 years now. Mm-hmm. And so a new paper has come out saying, wait a minute, I think we have a better model. And the constraints that you have to form are, first of all, you have to make a moon out of one impact, two impacts, or three impacts, and you have to duplicate the isotopic composition of the moon. So, interestingly, the moon's isotopic composition of things like iron and magnesium is very, very similar to the isotopic composition of the Earth. So they're kind of like made from the same material. It's as if you had like a bread and you had some dough and you make cupcakes and it makes some small breadlings over here and then to make a big loaf over here. And they're made out of the same, you can tell by the composition, the detailed composition, that they're made out of the same dough originally. So the Earth and Moon are kind of like that. And so that's one constraint on how did you form the Moon. Matter of fact, a couple of weeks ago, we talked about, hey, the thing that hit the Earth, to that one giant impact, had to have come from the inner part of the solar system, not the outer part. Why? Because the inner part of the solar system had been processed in the same way that the proto-Earth had been processed. So that's one way to accommodate the really close compositional similarities between them, Earth and Moon. But this new model says, hey, I think I can do it with three impacts.
Okay.
And so that's a nice, interesting difference. That always made much more sense to me because, as you can see, the moon is pockmarked by things that are bigger and bigger and bigger. And the biggest ones would have happened early. They would have disappeared because they saturated the – you know how – water, the hydrological cycle, erodes the surface of the Earth. Well, the impacts of all the subsequent craters, the impacts on the moon, would have erased the first ones. And so essentially, impacts are everywhere. The Earth formed from impacts and accretion, and just that bombardment kept on coming on, coming on, coming on. Gradually, the largest ones got swept up, and whether the largest ones that produced the moon were just one or two or three or 20 is, this is what we're trying to figure out. And this new model says, hey, I can do it with three large impacts. And that makes a lot of sense to me. I prefer that, matter of fact, to the one impact.
Hmm. Now, how did cats get domesticated? We don't quite know.
Well,
there are some new analysis which suggests a reason.
Well, you know, we've talked about trying to understand human evolution by looking at the DNA of people who were buried 1,000 years ago, 2,000 years ago, 5,000 years ago. As a matter of fact, there's a giant industry led by David Reich at Harvard University in which he digs up – well, you find fossils from 10,000 or 20,000 or 1,000, and then you look at the DNA – and you see, oh, in this particular place, the DNA, these type of people lived. And then 2,000 years later, whoa, a whole different type of person lived there, right? And so you can do that with any – you don't just do it with humans. You can do it with dogs. You can do it with cats. And so this new analysis did the same thing with cats. They did it in the Mediterranean world, but they also – a different group did it in China. And they found, okay, let's look at the domestication of cats. When did this cat get domesticated? Interesting background is that dogs got domesticated probably about 40,000 years ago, really, really early. They were really helpful to hunters and gatherers. Mm-hmm. But cats only became helpful when we became agricultural. So fairly recently, because then we had stores of grain. Stores of grain attracted rodents, and rodents were the stuff that the cats ate. So I said, yeah, we like these cats. But
so what does that mean? That means the Sumerians in the Middle East, is it? Is that where they started? Well, actually, the Egyptians love cats.
No, they love cats. That's right. So we know that the domesticated cat that we're all familiar with has been domesticated from the Libyan cat. Okay. And so a wild desert cat, and that's right where that's close to the Nile, where we had very, very large. I don't think Sumerians had cats, in fact. I'm not quite sure of this, but cats have been at least the cats we're familiar with now have been domesticated fairly recently. Matter of fact, the biggest result was, whoa, these cats that we all see are domesticated in the last 2,000 years.
Oh, really? Oh, that recently?
Yes, that's incredibly recent. And you should.
So those cats that the Egyptians had, because the Egyptian civilization is, what, 5,000 years old?
Yes, yes. And so, well, I'm not quite sure about what I'm going to say, but I think what they found out was the big spread of cats was about the year zero, about 2,000 years ago.
Okay.
And also the Carthaginians, or even the millennium before that, the Carthaginians seem to have a lot to do with spreading the cats around the Mediterranean. And interestingly, the first cat, the leopard cat that was kind of semi-domesticated in China, got replaced. They weren't able to domesticate it. And so then got displaced by the cat from that was domesticated from the northern, well, the one that the Egyptians domesticated.
What?
So
okay.
the Libyan cat just spread out all over the world. A caveat here is when I use these words, different cats' names, we're not quite sure. The idea of a species is something that you should try to forget as a nice classification for these things, because these are groups and subspecies and they can sometimes mate with each other a little bit and maybe not. It's the same thing that goes with Neanderthals and Denisovans. You know, we could interbreed with them, but sometimes we'd like to call them a different species, but they're really not, because we can interbreed and have fertile offspring. So it's a big mess, but you know, it's a nice mess because it's Darwinian evolution saying, hey, things change gradually with time, and to give it a box that's black and white is what's silly about I guess the classification of science.
Speaking of things that go extinct and all of that, and if you're rich, you can clone your pets these days. In fact, I talked to a person not so long ago that clones horses.
Yes, yes.
So, need anything go extinct anymore?
Well, that's that's the motto behind a company. Well, Viagen is a company, I think, out of Austin, where they make money cloning a cat, a dog, or a horse. And they cost about $50,000. Most famously, Tom Brady have cloned his favorite dog.
So that's right.
You have a dog, it gets old at, you know, 15, 20 years old, and they say, okay, I'm going to clone you. So you clone, then you have a puppy that's identical to the one you have. Now, it costs $50,000 because they still have not worked out the technical details. But they can do this with cats, they can do it with dogs, and they've done it, as you pointed out, with horses. And they do that because sometimes when you have a young male horse, they castrate it, and then it turns into a show. This is a great runner or a great whatever. And so they say, hey, I want to clone it. And so then they clone this. It's the only way to get the reproduction of this horse is to take its cells and I guess an adult cell, rejuvenate that adult cell, and then stick it into an egg, a horse egg, and then grow it. So that's one thing. But, you know, interestingly, there's a company called Colossal, and they have recently bought Viagen. Mm. And Colossal is a company that has this wonderful motto. It says something like, it says, extinction is a colossal problem facing the world, and Colossal is the company that's going to fix it. So these guys there's a billionaire named Ben Lamb, I think is his name. He's got like $5 billion and a gleam in his eye, and so he wants to – I guess he's been motivated by ecologists who say, hey, we have thousands of species that are going extinct every year because of us. Let's do something about it. And so when a species goes extinct, if you can read the DNA from those extinct animals, you have a fossil from one, then you get the DNA sequence. Then you find its most recent common, its sister species. Then you take that sister species egg, pull the DNA out, put in the new DNA, and then you will possibly grow something that's similar to the extinct animal. Like they did with – you may have heard of the dire wolf.
Yeah.
They did. So what they did, it was kind of
like – although people say that wasn't really a cloning.
Well, here's the thing. What is cloning mean? If you take – so what they did was dire wolves were very, very similar to wolves. And so there were, let's say, I don't know, maybe 1% of the DNA from a dire wolf was different from a wolf. And then you take, okay, I'm going to make it instead of the 1% different, I'm going to make it 0.5% different. So you're going to get something that's closer to a dire wolf. No, instead of 0.5%, I'm going to make 0.1% different. So you can get arbitrarily close to a dire wolf, just like we could bring back Neanderthals if we wanted to.
We could, yeah.
Because we know the Neanderthal genome, and a lot of – but you have gigantic issues about ethics. I'm a scientist. I'm not very good at ethics.
Who is going to be the uterus in which this thing has grown?
Well, I think you get a lot of interested – For example, I remember Sarah Hardy once volunteered to be impregnated by a chimpanzee to see if that would work. And everybody said, oh, that's crazy, crazy, you shouldn't do that. Well, you know, some people are crazy or semi-crazy. And so what's wrong with having an entity that's half chimp and half human? Or you laugh, but I mean, I think it's vanity to think we're so separate from the other creatures around us that we're so better that it would be unethical to even consider.
Well, that's true. Yeah.
I just don't share the ethical. I don't know. Maybe that's bad, but that's. I'm a scientist. I'm curious, and so was she. Now, this never happened. And matter of fact, there were some Russian scientists who tried this in 1920, and they did not succeed. And so we have a divergence with chimps about 6 million years, and that's a gap that's pretty far. But the Pan Troglodytes and Pan Paniscus, these are two chimps, these are bonobos and normal chimps, they're only 2 million years separate, and they can have sex with each other, and they have maybe fertile offspring. So like horses and donkeys, produce mules.
Mules.
Yeah. They're living things. What's wrong with a mule? But I guess they're not fertile. But there's a whole spectrum of hybridness that is sometimes it's viable, sometimes a little bit viable, sometimes it's not viable. But that spectrum is what we have to recognize as part of nature, not some humans are this and, you know, everything else is non-human, is not worthy. Okay. That's the part I want to push back on.
Hey, the origin of sperm has been traced back to a single-celled organism called a phylozoa.
Yeah. This is an interesting study. So this is out of Cambridge, and they wanted to trace back. You know, you in some sense, a sperm is like a unicellular organism. It's a single cell.
Well, it is, isn't it?
Yes,
it is. It's a single-celled wriggler.
A single-celled wriggler, okay. Anyway, when you analyze a sperm, a human sperm, for example, well, actually, they took many different sperm from many, many different animals, and then they identified about 300 gene families that are associated with the proteins that make up the sperm. So the single cell is made up of, let's say, 300 fundamental proteins. And then they analyzed these proteins and made phylogenetic trees to see which are the oldest proteins, which are more newly evolved. And they found out, the tail of these of sperm is very, very ancient. But the head is very, very new. And so there's a chronology from the tip to the tail of sperm. And that was an interesting feature. But also to say that, I mean, how old are sperm? Bacteria don't make sperm, and neither do archaea. And lots and lots of unicellular things are not sperm, and they don't make sperm. But they say 800 million, but I'd guess just round it off to a billion. About a billion years, sperm were invented by a unicellular organisms that diverged into this and eventually became us. They're phylozoa, and these are part of a bigger group called opisthokonts, which includes us and fungi. So there are all kinds of details about the phylogenetic tree and our origins, and if we go back far enough with any particular type of cell, particularly here with sperm, we will find the origin of that thing. And eyes, for example, eyes are not as old as a billion years, but sperm and the sperm tails are. One way to do this is you take a sperm and you cut it in half, or just cross-section, and you can see in cross-section there are these little pairs of dots you can see, and they're very much this is human sperm, and they're very, very much like 9 pairs of dots in phylozoa. So that, I mean, a billion years, there's been conservation of the pattern of the cross-section of the tails of sperm. And that's just another wonderful insight into our path, our evolutionary path, and how we got here. And let's know that we have ancestors 4 billion years ago, and our last universal common sperm was about a billion years ago, or 800 million, according to this new study. Wonderful new study.
How about that? All right. Charlie, always fascinating. Thank you.
All right. And are you going to clone yourself anytime soon, Phil?
How do you know it's not been done?
Yeah, well, that's right. It might already have been done, and I guess if you're a billionaire and you've cloned yourself you'd probably want to keep it a secret until...
the ABC might just have already done it, and this program will live forever.
All right.
Between that and AI.
But you don't have an extra 50,000, though, do you?
Sadly, no.
Maybe
I'm a bit short this week, Charlie.
Okay.
See ya.
Bye-bye.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.